You who are new tonight, I am Diagon Luke. And, this is the second of three evenings classes on a kind of, I could say, introduction to Nagarjuna. It's maybe more like getting our toe slightly wet in the sea of a essential and profound teaching of the middle way, the Buddha Madhyama Karika. And we are, I suggested that we do just one chapter, since the material is so rich and so dense, that the heart of the matter of the middle way presentation, Nagarjuna's presentation, and also Professor Garfield's presentation, occurs in the chapter called The Four Noble Truths, along with a commentary. Because if you try, as I said last week, to read the text straight without any commentary, whether it's this translation or one of the other translations, you would soon be lost, not knowing whether it is Nagarjuna who is speaking, or whether it is one of the proponents of some other Indian philosophy, which he is refuting with a dialectic of a kind of reductio ad absurdum argument. There's a few things just to, before we start. What we did last week, first of all, is I suggested that we read it together, that is to say, the verses and the commentaries together. Because I find that this particular presentation, Garfield's presentation, is really good in the sense that it's quite clear. He's really not writing it for Buddhologists, he's writing it for other academics and philosophers, and uses language that most of us can understand. To some extent. But this is an extremely subtle teaching, and the teaching of emptiness is consistently misunderstood by not only other schools and other philosophies or philosophers, but is misunderstood very often by proponents of the middle way themselves, by misunderstood that the idea of emptiness, of something being empty, does not negate in any way the fact that something exists. Just how something exists, or the status of phenomena in the world as phenomena, and how it exists as conventionally designated phenomena, that is to say, linguistically designated, and that all of this is dependently co-arisen, in that it has interrelated and interdependent and mutually sustaining aspect to it. That the emptiness is within the interdependence of all things, and that no particular entity within the phenomenon itself has an independent existence, if by independent status we mean a status that is permanent and autonomous, with our relationship to other things. The problem with this is that although we know, it doesn't take much subtlety of mind to understand the interdependence of things, what is not quite so clear to us is that this, the ultimate truth, is an aspect of conventional reality. It is not something that exists outside of our linguistic designations. It is not something that exists apart from the conventional world. It is, its status is found in the conventional world, by the conventional world, as we'll see, is another word for all of the normal reference, linguistic reference that we have in our social intercourse. What's interesting about this to me, and if I may just put a couple personal notes in here, is that the evolution of religious thought, if we think of the religious thought starting in some sort of even pre-mythical sense of the separation of oneself from the powers over which might be called natural powers, the power of nature or the power of the universe or whatever, that the individual felt quite lost in the primitive sense, and that the reaching out for some sort of supplication to the forces of the powers of the universe, the powers of life and death, is the sense that informs most religions in their early stages. And that was true in India. And that there seemed to be two approaches to how, as this feeling grew, that there was powers out there that we might possibly actually get in touch with, and if we just could find the language for it. That is to say, it was something that arose within ourselves, something that was imminent within the human psyche itself. If we could just find the language with which we could communicate with the powers that be, we might begin to control those powers. We might have some influence over what influences us, a kind of immanent sense. People that came down with their chariots, their war chariots out of Asia Minor and so on, and flooded into the Indus Plain in 4,000 years ago and so, already had this, the Aryans already had this sense of being able to share power with the greater whole. And so eventually this, of course, boiled down to the sense of there was a Godhead or a Brahman in which the universe is manifested, and that which is manifested in the universe is the same thing that's manifested in the individual. That the sense of correspondence is as above, so below. That we are a microcosm of the macrocosm and so forth. This idea. But we were still reifying, we were still solidifying, we were still substantiating the sense that there's something else out there over which, or under which, maybe, everything else is predicated or built upon. It wasn't until Buddhist time that, I think the big step that Shakyamuni Buddha made was to say that actually things were empty of even that sense of a substrat, of a building block, a basic building block in the universe. That there was no, it wasn't that there was no God, he didn't actually pronounce that, he wasn't interested so much in proving or disproving that, but that other than our social conventions, it cannot be found. So when we say then, when we say, well, something is empty, we're saying, what is it empty of? Well, we say, it's empty of our ideas. That when I say this is a book, the book from its side is empty of my imputations that this is a book. Calling it a book is this, what's called concept designation. It arises out of our perceptions of phenomena that is given a name. And if things are empty from their side of inherent existence, then the very language with which I am describing that is also empty of any inherent existence. There is no place, ultimately, that I can get a hold of something called reality, other than this convention we're talking about. This very moment, as I bring up these terms, what we're trying to do here is actually find new definitions for understanding who we are and how we relate to the universe, or to one another, or to phenomena, as phenomena. We are describing something, and those descriptions, because they're just reference, they're just words, are dependently co-arisen. They have no ultimate meaning in and of themselves. Therefore, we can say, as we have all learned, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness is no other than form. The problem with all of this, as soon as we hear these things, we take it, put it in front of us, and impute some substance to it. We reify. This reification, both of the independent self and of a world separate from the independent self, is something almost, one could say, In fact, certain schools do say that we're born with a tendency to immediately, in the sense of the division between the arising of phenomena and the consciousness that arises with phenomena, the phenomena and the consciousness arising together, the bifurcation or the separation between those two is so substantial in our minds and our dealings with the world that we're not even conscious of how we do this. And so, in some sense, what Nagarjuna, you could say, was an early deconstructionist. He kind of showed that all of this is a kind of a storytelling and a historical cultural event. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, all of this is conventionally designated and has no inherent meaning itself. Now, when he said that, and when this was proposed in India, it was, considered as an enormous, incredible heresy, because people say, well, if all things are empty, they immediately think that that means that nothing really has any existence. So why practice? And we have to remember also, finally, that Nagarjuna was not interested in just promulgating another philosophy. This was had a purpose, a soteriological purpose, a purpose of relieving us from this tendency to reify, to substantiate, to project upon phenomena our understanding of it as it is told to us by our parents or by our acculturating processes. And so to undo that whole affair, to see through that whole affair of this acculturation, and how we are constantly expanding our horizons and understanding through this acculturation process as a dependent co-arisen event, that there are no entities or identities within that that have an independent status. So even as we study Nagarjuna, we should understand that as we feel how we take this new information in and process it in terms in the light of, or in terms of, an and in the light of our prior understandings, and how that in itself is empty in the sense that it's a dependently co-arisen phenomena. Now, some of you weren't here last week. I don't think we can go back too much more and go over. We just started this chapter, I think it's 25. But before we do, I want to do the dedicatory verse. That's on page 100. In the Nagarjuna, we'll simply chant this together, because it is the heart of what Nagarjuna is talking about. In a nutshell. Everybody see that? Find that? Okay. So let's do that together. I prostrate to the perfect Buddha, the best of teachers, who taught that whatever is dependently arisen is unceasing, unborn, unannihilated, not permanent, not coming, not going, without distinction, without identity, and free from conceptual designation. It's okay. I want to just say one more thing, because it's so important. And I thought of it again today, because I told you last week that we have another book. There's a lot of translations, but it was Stephen Batchelor's translation of the Mulibandhyamaka called Verses from the Center. It's interesting if you compare his introductory remarks with Professor Garfield's introductory remarks regarding the question of language. And this is a central point that I think that this book brings forward, that, at least in my understanding of what Stephen Batchelor is saying, and many others, is that it's axiomatic in early Buddhism that a perception, that is to say, a perception of whether it's of any one of the senses is almost always mediated after the first 1/65th of a second, according to Chandrakirti. Is no longer a pure perception, but is mediated by concepts or our ideas. And our ideas are charged with feelings, the history, our emotional, what we call formations, emotional content, and so on. So what most meditation practices were about was to try to get back to what was called an unmediated or pure perception by practicing. That you could actually, through long and arduous practice, realize, quote, reality aside from a linguistic designation. And that would be a freeing event, that would be a freeing experience. But even Chandrakirti said there was no way to know that. There was no way to know that until concept designation arose almost simultaneously with it. In other words, I'm having an experience, but I can't tell you what it is. We've already described it. I can't tell you what it is. That's a description. It's not that we don't have experiences, but as soon as we try to describe them, we describe them in terms of what? Language, the conventions. So vis-a-vis that, there is this book out, which I have also would recommend to anybody who takes on Nagarjuna to understand. It's called The Philosophical Meditation on Zen Buddhism by Professor Dale S. Wright. And I'll just read one thing before we start this regarding language. You see, normally speaking, we think that there's a perception and that's the way the thing is, and then we find a word for it and we slap the word onto it. That language is a subsequent experience to the truth of our perceptions. And this is and I found that pretty much also what Stephen Batchelor seems to be saying. But this is not what Garfield is saying, that Nagarjuna is also saying. Because ultimately what Nagarjuna is saying is this, that there are three points. Whatever is dependently arisen is said to be empty. That in itself being a dependent designation is the middle way. There is no way out of your understanding it linguistically or through science outside of the conventional world. Now that's the subtle point. And according to Professor Wright, talking about the language in here, in this, he says that the model of language that I propose as an alternative to modern instrumental version hinges on the instrumental meaning slapping it on, hinges on the idea that language is already embedded in the content of our experience. It does not concede a clear demarcation between primary experience and the subsequent interpretation that we piece together out of language and then place upon the raw data of experience. Language is present even in the direct perception of an object. Language and perception co-arise. Big debate in many of the Buddhist schools about this. Although theoretically separable, they are indistinguishable in experience itself. How so? In accordance with the way in which, quote, understanding was articulated, we already understand that we perceive immediately as whatever it appears to be. Awareness of what it is that we perceive is intrinsically structured and comes to us directly in the perception itself. We perceive, quote, this as what it is, a book, a sound, a strange situation. These linguistically constructed images arise in the perception itself rather than subsequently. And he sums it up saying, anything not arising as italics, something, cannot be said to be experienced. So, I experience something as. I immediately give it, immediately reify it. I immediately put in the concept. But if I take that concept and don't understand that that is only a referent to other words under ideas, acculturation, and put it out in front of me and grasp it, as soon as I do that, I'm missing the point of the middle way. So ultimately, samsara and nirvana are the same, if we see it that. And what Nagarjuna will prove is that these two are not separable, but inseparable. Generally speaking, in the past, heaven, nirvana, has been at some other time, at some other place, under some other condition, we will understand it. But we who have practiced Zen know that if the divine or the crucial event is not that which is arising in the phenomena right now, where the hell is it? And all of our practices was to help us to precipitate us into the present moment fully and seeing the ungraspability of any aspect of that, intrinsically speaking. Okay. I hope that doesn't confuse you all the more. So chapter...
Do we have questions?
Yes, of course, of course. That's
so close. Are you saying that although theoretically there's perception and then language, the way it really is for humans is they happen at the same time.
Yes.
But are you saying that there's understanding emptiness is just comprehending that that's the way it is and not expecting anything else?
No, because if we comprehend that that's the way it is and reify that's the way it is, then they'll say that's just another conceptual designation. That's just another story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that there's nothing else. No, if a baby falls down who has no language and hits its head, the baby hits something, he's going to cry. There comes a point, however, when the child touches the table and mama says, table. Not only table, but eventually it's daddy's table. It's a good table. It's a beautiful table. It begins to have all of these imputations given to it. This happens so early in our life that to describe our experience is to understand our experience, and to understand our experience is to communicate, that is to say, mutually or dependently co-arisen as a conventional, as a socially, the status is socially conventional. Yes. So he will talk about that in this chapter and try to bring this clearly forward to us.
Okay. Is it possible to name something without separating yourself from it, without subjectifying it? In other words, language can one person says it colorizes, the other person says it separates with the initial experience. I'm just wondering if you use that. A person can see it, name it.
We can tell any story we want about it. We can say it's subjective. We can say it's objective. We can have any number of philosophies about it. All Nagarjuna is saying, those are dependently co-arisen aspects of our experience. Those are stories that we tell each other. They're verifiable according to social conventions.
What's the alternative?
There's no alternative. There is no, that's what he's saying. This is already it.
So we're
separate. Right, well, when I say this is already it, you say that's a story. So I don't quite get the distinction between what I was saying and what you're saying.
I don't know that we have any distinction.
Oh.
Yeah. Other than we're right now, what we're doing is you're putting out a question. I hear the question, your words. I find language in which to meet your question. This is a dependently co-arisen event right here, right? Yeah. As long as we see that that's what's happening,
yeah,
and understand it in those terms, then we understand it's emptiness. That's all. Emptiness is not something underlying. That's not something that is an entity in itself. And Nagarjuna will really get into showing us, if we ever get into the chapter here. Okay, so last week we got as far as, I think, page 296. Is that correct?
I thought we were on chapter 25.
We are.
No, I think it's
24.
24, I mean, Four Noble Truths. 296, page 296. I think that's as far as we got. We got to, what happens in the beginning of these verses is that in the previous versus Nagarjuna has been talking in this vein, and the opponent says, now wait a minute. If you're saying that all things are empty, then the Four Noble Truths are empty, then the Buddha is empty, the Dharma is empty, and so forth. And this is nihilism. So when you get down to, did we do 7 and 8 last week? Do you remember? Did we get to 7? You see at the bottom of page 296? Anyway, let's start with the paragraph just above number 7, or Karika 7. Nagarjuna launches a reply. Huh? Is that right? Nagarjuna launches the reply by charging the opponent with foisting the opponent's own understanding of emptiness on Nagarjuna. Though this is not made explicit in the text as one might like, it is important to note that the underlying understanding Nagarjuna has in mind is one that, in the terms of the Madhyamika, reifies emptiness itself. This will be made more explicit, so forth, and it will be. 7, he says, we say that this understanding of yours of emptiness and the purpose of emptiness and of the significance of emptiness is incorrect. As a consequence, you are harmed by it. Nagarjuna. The Buddhist teaching of the Dharma is based on two truths. Now here's a significant point. A truth of worldly convention and an ultimate truth. This is the first explicit announcement of the two truths in the whole text, actually. It is important to note that they are introduced as two truths, that they are introduced as distinct. This will be important to bear in mind later, for it is tempting, since one of the truths is characterized as an ultimate truth, to think of the conventional as, quote, less true.
Say that again?
We will think that the ultimate truth has a status higher than the conventional truth. We already reify. There's something called the ultimate truth. Moreover, we see later that while the truths are introduced as quite distinct here, they are in another sense identified later. It will be important, this is an underline, it will be important to be very clear about the respective senses in which they are distinct and one. In other words, what Nagarjuna is saying, what this text is explicating, is the use of a kind of logic, a logical way, a mental way, a conceptual way of understanding what the middle path is. And Nagarjuna, and particularly as it was interpreted later through Chandrakirti and Buddha Lapita and others, that we as human beings have to first come to it conceptually if we want to understand the middle way. The term translated here of the truth of worldly convention, which is...
There's no other way to come to it. No,
yeah, right. Well, according to this version of, if you believe in the Madhyamaka, a lot of other... But what Nagarjuna is going to try to show you is that if we follow the rules of certain logic, with what's called the tetralemma, a thing is, a thing isn't, a thing both is and isn't, and a thing neither is nor isn't. It has to be one of those four. He will show that each one of those propositions in and of itself can be refuted by other propositions because it's all dependently co-arisen. So, he says it denotes a truth, that is to say, the truth of worldly convention, or samvritti satya, denotes a truth dependent upon tacit agreement, an everyday truth, a truth about things as they appear to accurate ordinary investigation as judged by appropriate human standards. This is a crucial point because there's a lot of literature and commentary written in both Tibetan texts, to some extent our own Zen literature, about what a valid perception or valid conception is. And there's many distinctions made. They go all the way back, in fact, to the Abhidharma, but it's important to understand the difference between, well, we'll talk about this, than some fantasy I have. The usual thing is the fantasy that appears in my mind, such as a unicorn, for example. Or they use that as one, which is something I can imagine, which is the object of my concept, but does not appear in the daily world. We have a lot of that kind of that level of perception and conception of fantasies, but they're still linguistically designated. We know what a unicorn looks like, although nobody's ever seen a unicorn. We can imagine what a hare or a rabbit with horns looks like. We sometimes see them in gas stations if you drive out west. Have been manufactured by somebody, some cowboy. But they don't exist in the natural world, but we can imagine those kind of things. We can also understand that a perception, for example, of waves on the desert looking like water, it is not water, but the mirage, as a mirage, is real. So those, there are many distinctions here about what we are talking about in the sense of judged by appropriate human standards. The term ultimate truth, paramartha satya, denotes the way things are independent of convention, or to put it another way, the way things turn out to be when we subject them to analysis with the intention of discovering the nature they have from their own side, as opposed to the characteristics we impute to them. And I'll read the next two, and then we can do as we did last week, if that meets your approval of each of us reading maybe an aspect of this. Karika 9. Those who do not understand the distinction drawn between these two truths do not understand the Buddha's profound truth. Remember that one of the understandings of the early middle way was, in the most simplest terms, falling the way between the path between extreme asceticism and extreme worldliness. Neither, you know, involving ourselves in ascetic practices in which the transcendent desire to reach God was understood to be attained by humiliating the physical senses or eliminating the physical senses in the yogic practices. Buddha tried those, we know, and it didn't work for him particularly. But the middle way, as is in this very subtle teaching of the Mula Madhyamaka, or the Madhyamaka, the middle way teaching, is the understanding of the two truths, the conventional and the ultimate, as being one and the same in some sense. Without a foundation in, now here's important, without a foundation in the conventional truth, the significance of the ultimate cannot be taught. Without a foundation in the conventional truth, the significance of the ultimate cannot be taught. Without understanding the significance of the ultimate, liberation is not achieved. Is that clear? Okay, would you please read the beginning?
The goal of the Madhyamika philosophy is liberation from suffering. But that liberation, on Nagarjuna's view, can only be achieved by insight into the ultimate nature of things, their emptiness, and indeed into the ultimate nature of emptiness, which we shall see to be emptiness again. But this insight can only be gained through reasoning and hence through language and thought.
And hence through language and thought. Please note. Thank you. Go on.
And the truth that is to be grasped can only be indicated through language and thought, which are thoroughly conventional and which can only be interpreted literally at the conventional level. It is important to see here that Nagarjuna is not disparaging the conventional by contrast to the ultimate, but is arguing that understanding the ultimate nature of things is completely dependent upon understanding conventional truth.
Just stop for a second. One of the reasons that in Zen practice, for example, so much importance is placed on the everyday. Everyday mind is Zen. When you're cutting carrots, just cut carrots and so on. That many of the earlier teachings was the feeling that I've got to get through this material world somehow to get to the ultimate. But when we understand that the ultimate and the conventional are one and the same, then cutting carrots or carrying water or chopping wood, as we've heard, all of these Zen koans, for example, are based on these two truths. The student comes in stuck on some ultimate truth, the master cuts him down to size by slapping him in the face or something. If he, on the other hand, is stuck totally in the conventional truth and has reified something, the master takes that away. The teacher takes that away. So the teaching or the monastic practice, particularly in Zen, particularly in Soto Zen, with all of its ceremonial aspects, ceremoniousness, is the paying attention to the details of our life, and to see that first by understanding the conventional, working with the conventional, we can begin to really grasp, not a good word to use, is it? To feel what the ultimate is about. Okay?
This is true in several senses. First, as we shall see, understanding the ultimate nature of things just is understanding that their conventional nature is merely conventional. But second, and perhaps less obscurely, in order to explain emptiness, the ultimate nature of all phenomena, one must use words and concepts and explain such things as interdependence, impermanence, and so forth. And all of these are conventional phenomena. So both in the end, where the understanding of ultimate truth is in an important sense the understanding of the nature of the conventional, and on the path, where the cultivation of such understanding requires the use of convention, conventional truth must be affirmed and understood.
And one of the things that in the training that I've received anyway, is that until we really explore what we consider the conventional life, that is to say, I push ourselves further and further into the conventions. What are the limits of the conventions? What is the limit? You can keep pressing. If we simply sit back and feel that I've read this now, for example, but in some way don't test it. And how do you test it? Push yourself into the world in such a way that it really tests you. In other words, what we would call a challenge. The conventional, we're challenging ourselves in the conventionality of the world. That the conventional world is not a limited world, because it is empty and doesn't co-arise. It is a world that's infinite in its possibilities. But we stop at some point. Most of us will stop at some point and say, we have to stop at some point, actually. Say, this is the limit upon which I can go. But what practice tries to do is, both in our mental understanding and even in our physical understanding, such as in Seishin and so, is to push those limits of the conventional. Push us to the edge of what we understand and think. Say, this is the limit upon which I can go. But what practice tries to do is, both in our mental understanding and even in our physical understanding, such as in Seishin and so, is to push those limits of the conventional. Push us to the edge of what we understand and think is our conventional world, beyond that limit, to get to a new place of intensity, whereby new possibilities unfold for us. So that when they write, you know, the Zen circle, what do we call that again? Yeah. It's open circle. The universe is an open, ended possibility. And the universe, in this sense, is no different from our conventional world. But we treat the conventional world as if it's a solid thing. That's the problem. We don't see it as conventional. We see it as something solid. And we can't help that. We're born into it. We understand our world from the inside of it. There's no way of stepping out of it. So by pushing the limits of ourselves in both intellectual and physical ways.
What's another way of defining the conventional?
Whatever is dependently co-arisen.
I mean, something that I don't understand, so I don't understand that. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to get you to say something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, what are you doing right now? What are you doing right now?
Asking you a question.
Yeah, but what does that mean? You're asking me a question. What's the process by which that's happening? Are you doing it this way? You're doing it verbally. You're using language. You're using words. That's convention. That's what conventionality is. Now, all conventions, you can use other kinds of signs in convention, such as if I were deaf, you could use this. But still, those are conventions.
Yeah, what is the notion of redefine reality?
Yes.
Form?
Yes.
So how do you push it? I'm just trying to understand, how do you push
it? You push it. One of the ways you push it is to find out if it has any solidity to it. That's one of the ways of meditating upon it. That's what essentially Vipassana is about. Mm-hmm. Is to see if you can hang on to any mental or any conceptual or perceptual phenomena whatsoever. If there's a you that separate from those perceptions that arise. The only way we can understand this is to describe it to one another. That's all within our conventional. In other words, you're asking me a question and I'm trying to fill you in with some language somehow. So that your understanding of what we mean by conventional opens, this is what I mean by acculturation, it opens the horizon a little bit further from what you understood before. But constantly, new concepts are constantly pushing old concepts until such a place that we give up and stop and say, that's the reality, that's my reality. But what Nagarjuna is saying is that my reality is just a conventional designation of what you think reality is. It's an expression, linguistically designated, of your reality, of your understanding. That's all we can do as human beings.
Or my limits.
Yeah.
The limits,
what you think are your limits. But you think that they're your limits. But at the same time, is there a you separate from the limits that you're setting for yourself? You see, we have the idea, don't you have the idea that there's a you, a separate, that there's this you that you experience when you're 3 years old, when you're 10 years old, when you're 20 years old, when you're 50 years old, when you're 70 years old. Everything else seems to be changing, and your body and so on, your mind is changing, but there's still this subjective self sense of being you. But when Arjuna and others are saying, you cannot find that you separate from the phenomena in which it is occurring. And part of that phenomena in which you understand, and the main component of that phenomena, is your understanding through concepts, through words, through language. Okay? At least that's my interpretation and understanding of what he is saying about what Nagarjuna is saying. This is what we're always doing. Nobody knows what after all, who knows what was like, what these words really meant in Nagarjuna's time. So let's understand that this is an interpretation of an interpretation of an interpretation, ad infinitum and even ad nauseum. That's what we're always doing. That's what we're doing tonight. This is empty in any ultimate sense. If we can see that and take that back into the world with us, then we don't maybe get caught so much by our ideas and our reactive tendencies built up through the reification process. The soul ceremony that we've been involved in our whole life. Okay, let's go. Where are we?
Number 11.
Yeah. Could you go on, please? Yes. It's been said many times that there's nothing worse than a sudden understanding of a little bit that emptiness, I've got it, and then reifying emptiness. It's better to think that things inherently exist than to take emptiness, put that in front of you, and that's called jumping out of the fire, the frying pan into the fire, or, as he says, grabbing a snake. Don't reify emptiness. We will see that emptiness is a concept, a conventional concept to try to understand something. But as soon as we turn it into and put it in front of us and grasp at it, you're lost. And you're really lost. Because that's nihilism. And he'll try to show that. Okay? Who's next? Could you go on, please? Page 300.
Yamashita's doctrine of emptiness is subtle and it is easily misinterpreted. In particular, it is often misinterpreted as thoroughgoing nihilism about phenomena. This is so not only among Indian critics, classical Indian critics of Madhyamaka, in both Buddhist and non-Buddhist philosophical schools, but also among Western critics, who have sometimes regarded it as completely negative. In this respect, Madhyamaka philosophy has suffered from the same fate as much Western skeptical philosophy, including that of the
Prahians,
of Hume, and Wittgenstein, all of whom were at considerable pains to warn readers against interpreting them as denying the existence of ordinary entities, of all of whom have been repeatedly read as doing so. Nagarjuna is here charging the opponent, represented in the opening verses, with interpreting the assertion that a phenomenon is empty as the assertion that it is non-existent. Nothing, Nagarjuna will argue, could be further from the truth.
That's a pretty self-explanatory. If you get a chance, read the footnotes. They're very interesting because we have a professor right now, Professor Wood, who's I think in San Francisco with at Kennedy. Is that the name of the university?
Kennedy.
Yeah. I think so. JFK. I think he's a professor there. He really does hold the position that Nagarjuna is totally nihilistic. It's very interesting to read the different. And Kalupahana has a little different. So don't think there's unanimity exactly what this means. But what Garfield points out, the fact that we do not have unanimity is because it is dependently co-arisen is empty of any inherent existence. Naturally, according to our understanding of what words of reference are by our own experience, there will be many interpretations of this. Yeah. No, don't.
For that reason, the Dharma is deep and difficult to understand and to learn. The Buddhist mind is spared of being able to teach it. You have presented fallacious refutations that are not relevant to emptiness. The confusion about emptiness does not belong to me. The Nagarjuna here simply denies that his view sustains a nihilistic reason, while granting that if one treats emptiness as non-existence, all of the absurd conclusions that the opponents enumerates included follow. When the Nagarjuna continues in 24:14, the interpretation of the entire Madhyamaka system depends directly on how one understands the concept of emptiness. If that is understood correctly, everything else falls into place. If it is misunderstood, nothing in the system makes any sense. 14. For him to whom emptiness is clear, everything becomes clear. For him to whom emptiness is not clear, nothing becomes clear. When you foist on us all of your errors, you are like a man who has mounted his horse and has forgotten that very horse.
Okay. Go on, Ali.
Here is the idea behind this image. A standard cloud in classical Indian rhetoric. A man with a herd of horses thinks that he is missing one and accuses you of having stolen it. As he rides around and counts his horses, he always comes up one short. But you point out to him that the one he is accusing you of stealing is in fact the very one he is writing but has forgotten to count. Likewise, when the Bhimit is saying, the opponent who confuses the Madhyamaka analysis in terms of emptiness of nihilism in charging Nagarjuna with a nihilism that is in fact his own. Nagarjuna will argue, that is, that while the opponent claims to preserve the reality of the three jewels, the four noble truths, and dependently arisen phenomena against Nagarjuna's nihilism. Nagarjuna himself can explain the reality of these things, though it will turn out that on the opponent's view they must be non-existent. At this very point, the positive philosophical program of this chapter begins.
16.
There are two related assertions contained in this paragraph. First, that the commands of the opponent, the very first that the opponent exists, is different character, to be unable to account for the human reality, and hence for anything that must be the kind of realism. If not the genuine is explicit data, this will include such things as suffering, its causes, the mind, the conversation, the drama, the sadness, and the fear, as well as normal danger. But secondly, and most subtly, since the opponent is seeing the actual existence as a discrete entity, when in essence, it would follow that there is pain, the reality of emptiness would entail the emptiness of self in the entity, and inherently exist in the entity of
that. You see that? Everybody catch that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Would you read that again slowly? But secondly,
and most subtly, since the opponent is seeing the actual existence
existence has an essence.
Reified.
It's reified. It's mm-hmm. separate. There's such a thing called existence. You see, okay. Yes. Yes.
It would follow that the opponent, the reality of emptiness, would entail that emptiness itself is away. And inherently existence.
Right. He's saying that you're saying that things are empty, that existence is empty, so he's reifying both existence and emptiness. He's not saying that they dependently call arisen ideas. Now, this is really important because even today I had a practice discussion with somebody who actually believed that emptiness is something. He's really trying to achieve in his or her practice a grasp of the phenomenon of emptiness. This person is verified that underneath everything is emptiness. There's a great void. And if I could just get through my perceptions and concepts, I will know what that void is and then I'll know what truth is. This is really a stubborn, very stubborn thing in religious practice to see through.
If Nagarjuna would adopt the view of emptiness, he would indeed have to deny the reality of the entire phenomenon of conventional world. This would also be to describe a special non-conventional, non-dependent, cultural reality of emptiness itself. Ordinary things can be believed in existence, emptiness is substantial existence. It is important to set that
and this is what I mentioned last week as the verse to, without reifying it, laminate it, memorize it, put it in your wallet. Whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is explained to be emptiness. That, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. There it is. If you can remember that one phrase and use that as a kind of koan in your life, this is a good translation, by the way. I like it better than that. Yeah. Whatever is dependently co-arisen is said to be empty. You can understand it. That, what I just said, what that explanation is, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. If you can get that. So, Let's just read the next one. Something that is not dependently arisen, such a thing does not exist. Therefore, a non-empty thing does not exist. All right. We've reached the crux of this chapter, although the explications that are going to follow are help us to understand or deepen our understanding, however shallow that may be, of what has preceded. This is the crucial verse in the whole book. And as I said, I'm going to this chapter because this chapter sums up many of the earlier arguments about causation. And this verse is a summation of this chapter. So this is why when we studied the Mula Madhyamika and Tassahara, everybody memorized this aspect and discussed it ad infinitum. Okay. But just before we quit here, let's just read the next verse. These two verses demand careful scrutiny and are best discussed together. Nagarjuna establishes a critical, get this, three-way relation between emptiness, dependent origination, and verbal convention. Three ways between emptiness, dependent origination, and verbal convention, and asserts that this relation itself is the middle way toward which his entire philosophical system is aimed. So, if you read this and go on to 305, let's go on to 305. We just have to read the rest of this. No way to. As we shall see, this is the basis for understanding the emptiness of emptiness itself. Nagarjuna is asserting that the dependently arisen is emptiness. Emptiness and the phenomenal world are not two distinct things. They are rather two characterizations of the same thing. To say of something that it is dependently co-arisen is to say that it is empty. To say that something is empty is another way of saying that it arises dependently. Moreover, and here it is, underline it, whatever is dependently co-arisen is verbally established. That is, the identity of any dependently arisen thing depends upon verbal conventions. To say that a thing that is dependently arisen is to say that its identity as a single entity is nothing more than its being the referent of a word. The thing itself, apart from conventions of individuation, has no identity. To say of it, no, now the key word is identity. And this is very interesting because people that have identity crises, I know we all do, is because we don't understand the dependently co-arisen from moment to moment. And we latch on to one aspect or another of it. And we don't see that this is all based on verbal convention. Since the very time that your father or mother or told you you were not good enough, or you're wonderful, or you're going to be a doctor, or whatever. The thing itself, apart from conventions, has no identity. To say of a thing that its identity is merely verbal fact about it is to say that it is empty. To view emptiness in this way is to see it neither as an entity nor as unreal. It is to see it as conventionally real. If you can get that, just go over that and think about that and use that. This is incredible help. And then as you do that, notice if you're reifying that idea, making that into a story and grasping that.
Once you say a non-empty thing does not exist, that's conception.
Yeah, that's a convention. And that's what we are. That's what we are doing. Just don't reify. But if I say don't reify, you reify the non-reification.
Well, you see.
Who look exactly the same as it is. It's just that you would, and this is all mental, because the whole trip about particularly Tibetan meditation and so on is to lead you to a place through a whole logical analysis and so on where actually, after practicing shamatha and vipassana for years and years and years, you get to a place where you walk around and nothing, you don't reify anymore. You've learned to let that ceremony go. You've learned that the you that lets that ceremony go only exists conventionally. So you'd be free. But that doesn't mean you wouldn't feel things. You feel exactly everything that you feel now. Yes. No, no, to relieve suffering.
So that there's some way in which the studying of him and the seeing him,
yes, 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 yes,
is supporting a way of relating to one another.
Yes.
Suffering.
Right. Exactly. This is upaya, or skillful means. The emptiness doctrine is skillful means in Buddhism to let go. To let go. And to, even at that idea, to see that that is a condition, and to see that you have no choice but that. But we don't live that by letting go. We hang on to different aspects of our life. So the meditation practice is to pick up something like a thought, and to sit with the thought, to watch it arise, the mind and the feeling, to watch its duration, to watch it dissipate, to watch it pass away, only to be immediately replaced by another thought. One thought pushing on another thought. One feeling pushing on another feeling. And what is this I that is feeling it? Can you find the I apart from that process? Forever to actually reach the place where we release. There are people who are released in this world.
Well,
and there are moments when I think so. In fact, we're released right now.
We're always
released. And if we thought that we weren't, and we reify the idea that we are suffering, he shows that suffering, all of these are empty concepts, ultimately empty. Suffering is empty. That is to say, it's based on causes and conditions. When the causes and conditions no longer obtain, feeling no longer obtains. When this arises, that will arise. When these conditions are not in there. But that's not how we feel our life. We feel our life as something solid. I do. I don't know about you. Even though I've studied this stuff for years, I'm constantly verifying my life. I'm constantly in control. I'm constantly separating myself. But I can see through the process of meditation and reading these teachings and the Dharma that has been handed down in these forms that what it is saying as I read it, I can understand that my understanding is changing and is independent, co-reason, and event. That's a way of describing it to myself, which is different from the way I described the world yesterday and the year before and so on. So in that sense, it's a gradual process. The Tibetans say that is a little bit different from us, but by us I mean the Zen school, but what they feel is that you have to practice shamatha first. You have to really focus the mind on some, either the breath or some mental image all the time. Bring your mind back. Bring your mind back. Bring your mind back. Whatever you're doing, for days, months, years, you keep doing that. And according to some, some teachers, in their tradition at least, they say very few people ever can accomplish that. Once you can accomplish that, and the mind is focused in that sense, on one thing, then you can begin to practice vipassana. Vipassana meaning to analyze all of the aspects of phenomena that arise, mental and physical components of your experience. However, there's a whole other school called Zen or Dzogchen, which is bare raw awareness or Shikantaza, that the awareness itself, just as it is already, as we reify it, is the Buddha Dharma. This is no different actually from what he is saying, except we don't know it. The reification, the process by which we are reifying the world is also, because it is empty, and is also, you know, the Buddha Dharma. It is. In other words,
Zen says you don't have to look behind appearances to understand reality. Appearances are reality, just don't grab onto any aspect of the appearance. Or if you do, find out who's trying to grab onto it. So there is this also teaching of bare awareness. And what was the tulku that came to Zen Center? Said to Reb, what's your practice? And he said, you just do shikantaza, I'm just sitting. You just sit? Well, that's the most advanced practice, to ask people just to sit and let their minds go. People have to slowly go through a long re-acculturating, or what should I say, deconstructing process and so on before they can possibly do that. In other words, you have to get your life in order, you have to practice the precepts, you have to do all these other things. Shamatha, Vipassana, and so forth. And go through the logical and analytical processes of the Prajshamikas, or the Prajshamika school. But Dogen Zenji doesn't say it. Dogen Zenji says, this mind, the delusion is, we're greatly deluded about enlightenment. And enlightened people are greatly enlightened about delusion. In other words, we see that the two worlds are the same. It's just the view by which we see it. Now we see it as not dependent or arisen, or empty, and now we see it as it is. Dependently co-arisen and empty. Isn't that the first three verses of the Genjo Koan? Anyway. Last week we said we'd break up into groups and talk for a few minutes. Do you want to do that? Or just questions back and forth? We get a discussion going here. Yeah.
I read the chapter 24. I haven't read that before. In chapter 24, he defines emptiness pretty much in the chapter, so many times he encounters the kind of disillusion. He doesn't define it by itself. So it's almost like he's just using two terms for one thing.
Define it by itself, okay, I don't quite.
Well, in this chapter really seems like it's essentially about kind of picking all the ladders out from under everything he's still got. That's what I think that. That's what he says he means, even emptiness itself, the concept.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
So there's kind of self transcendence of the whole system.
Self transcending.
He's transcending the whole philosophical system, saying, well, you know.
But he's not transcending it into some other system. He's right. Transcending it, saying that this. The ultimate is found as a convention. The ultimate is a convention.
Let me ask the question a different way.
Yeah.
Why do you bring up emptiness? What does it add to the discussion? Or since we talked about it always in terms of the point of original, how much to say emptiness?
Well, you could. You could, but the trouble is that emptiness or dependent origination gets to be reified, gets to be something.
It's like calling it by a different name.
I think that's true. They're synonymous. And the verbal conventions in which we articulate this is synonymous with those two things. Since we can see we're doing it right now.
So, what is he adding on to what the Buddha already said?
Well, he's not necessarily adding on to what the Buddha already said, except that in the early schools, you know, they begin to articulate, they begin to substantiate various aspects. The Abhidhamma, for example, as try to break the world down into you know, at least the Sankaranika school tried to break the world down into 75 dharmas, aspects of mental and psychological phenomena, which, although they were dependently co-arisen, when they came together as causes and conditions, they were those which constituted what they called the person at that moment. But the later school, Madhyamaka, said, you can't even do that. In fact, Nagarjuna, in some sense, will go so far as to say, other than conventionally, you cannot ontologically prove your existence. Other than conventionally.
So he's creatively reinventing the Buddha's work in response to that, which is the bottom.
Yes, and yes. If it was independently arisen, it wouldn't have, it couldn't change. It wouldn't be any change.
And it wouldn't be perceivable by us. Mm-hmm.
Well?
By definition, anything that would be independent would not have a conventional.
He says at some point in that, if there's even one thing in the universe that is independent, then all things are independent. You can't have one thing that is not dependently co-arisen.
Are you finding with that there's maybe something going on that we can't perceive?
Well, one thing is that the universe itself, when we say the universe,
yeah,
that's clearly empty of dependence.
Right.
But there is a sense of there being something behind that.
Yeah.
That we can't prove does not exist.
Well, the whole thing is that as soon as you try to prove that something exists beyond the convention, you get into kind of speculation and not right. That's what he's saying. The Buddha was not interested in trying to talk about the millions of dimensions that may exist within phenomena. It's just the point of view with which you see it. That's all Nagarjuna is saying. After all, phenomena exist, but my point of view of seeing it is different from probably even a dog's point of view, and certainly from a bee's point of view. And God knows what a lizard must see with his eyes turning in all directions, both eyes and so on. But what the lizard makes a phenomena. He says they don't have a feedback cortex problem. When you tell them that they're seeing it, they don't have self-consciousness in the sense that we do. See, the human dimension is that we know something and we know that we know something. And that arose because we have a feedback in our evolution called the cerebral cortex that gives us information back. I can feel that. In other words, that I'm a separate entity and that there's something called a universe out there separate from me, that there's such a thing as a past and a future.
You say there's such a thing as essentially have a free will and make choices.
Am I saying what?
There's no such thing as free will. That's really all codependent on the economy.
Those causes and conditions, but those causes and conditions are not separate from you. You're making things determine you and you determine things. When you're angry, when you might have a karmic reaction in your life to a certain situation, and we can talk about anger forever here, abstractly speaking, but the next time you're angry, the only time, at that moment when you're angry, there can be a gap. Because you have programmed yourself, what you call yourself, with some new information which says, if I just feel the anger, but don't react, in other words, don't leak it, don't spread it out, don't respond, just feel it. If I can do that, then I can change my responses over it. I can reprogram myself. But what is myself in that? You see, is there something, is function and essence two things? When someone asks you, what do? You go to a cocktail party, what do? Oh, I sell things, or I'm a Buddhist monk and so on. Is there some separation between my function and who I am? Now, underneath we think there is. There's me. I'm not just the functions in the world. But even if there is, there's no way that I can make that clear to anyone else except by demonstrating it to you. How do I demonstrate it to you? By the various things I say about myself. By the various things I say about the functions of myself in the world. Do you think there's such a thing as a world apart from you? Martha's world, and Michael's world, and David's world, and Arlene's world, and Jeff's world? There is phenomena, and we have
invented a way among ourselves of describing that phenomenon. But it's a description. I think Sir John Eccles, the great physicist, the great English physicist, said, you should know there's no colors out there. There's no such thing as color out there. So this is something that we make up in our minds, that arises in the human mind together. This is a quantum swarm of energy. Through our perceptual apparatus, we make sense out of it. And through that perceptions, we then linguistically designate what that's about, and we discreetly break down the world into manageable units through our language. And that's the conventional world in which we live. And the conventions of our society are slightly different from the conventions of other societies. The conventions of your family are different from other families, and the conventions of you within the family are different. No wonder half the world is always upset because the other half is trying to take away their conventions. That's what war is about. That's what conflict is about. Where do we draw the line? About when you step over that line into my conventional world, which is my security, my sense of who I am, there's conflict. The whole idea of becoming a monk once upon a time was to give up the world in the sense of not having attachment to nothing to defend. And to be able to investigate, is there such a thing as a self separate from that that comes forward? But as long as we have something to defend, something to hold on to, something to manage, we're going to draw a line and say, don't step across that. It's war if you do. It's conflict if you do. But the early Buddhists were willing, you know, when the Mongol hordes swept down Nalanda and so on, they put out their necks. And the Muslims were amazed that they could slice off so many Buddhist heads with impunity, and that gave rise to the Sufi movement. Well, I think that's what to study the way is to study the self. Right? What is the self? To study the self is to forget the self. When you forget the self, all things come forward to confirm who you are. Another way of saying, when I really study and look for who I am, what do I find? I find you. I find everything else. But everything else can't exist with without what I call me also arising. That's the dialectic. If there's you, there's me.
But then if you go on to describe having had that experience.
That's a description of the world. Mm-hmm. That's a description of your world, the way you understand that. There's not one Buddhist teaching. If there was, we wouldn't, I mean, if there was a changeless identity called Buddha that has come down since time out of mind that we all already have, that would be dependently co-arisen. That would stand over and against what we're talking about here. And in the next chapter, he talks about nirvana and samsara being the same thing. But you can't say that nirvana is a compounded phenomenon, the same as you can say that conventional existence is a compounded phenomena. Nirvana is understanding and living in that understanding as that understanding of everything being compounded and changing. In other words, actually dropping in to what is always already the case. But just the joke of it all, I think.
Can you explain how Buddha nature is dependently co-arisen?
Buddha nature is a concept, and you just mentioned it. What is Buddha nature? And what is Buddha nature?
Well, I'm saying what we talk about as Buddha nature being that thing that which is a constant, which I, you know, or something that everybody has.
Yeah, but that's everybody has. But that's a conventional. You just described something.
Right.
See? So there is a whole school in Buddhism called the Tathagata Garba school.
Yeah.
The Tathagata Garba gets back to the idea that underneath, you couldn't know what Buddhism is unless there was already consciousness there that would give rise to something called Buddha. Although they say that is empty, what they say it is empty of is defilement. It is pure. It is immaculate. It is
if you read those descriptions of what that school thinks Buddhism is, and you read Vedanta, for example, side by side, it's very hard to tell the difference, frankly. But we need to feel there's such a thing as Buddha nature. We need to feel there's such a thing as God. We need to feel there's some kind of substrate. We want to feel that. But if you have a moment of realizing we're already in free fall, there is nothing that can be grasped. There is nothing that can, well, grasped. There can nothing that can be clung to. And that if we examine that very idea, it's very scary to us. Other than the fact that these are stories we tell each other. And they're necessary stories. As we are. But they're stories. And that process itself, you see, is already Buddha. That was Suzuki Roshi. That thing we're already doing is already Buddha. That's another name I just gave to it. But it's a sense of tremendous freedom to be able to know that, to feel that, to live from that disposition. Even for a moment. Oh, I'm already that. We are already that. Call it what you will. But what is that? You see, now I give it back. You describe it. I describe it. We see that we bring these dependently, give rise to this together. Along with the sun, the moon, the air we breathe, the food we eat, and so forth. And that's it. Well, we want something else. We want security, and we want consolation in the midst of the fact that
we want ecstasy, some kind of longing to be met.
Yeah, we want to melt away into something bigger than ourselves.
That one next week.
Well, thank you very much. Do we also Nagarjuna's 70 stanzas, David Camino's book, is a wonderful book for also explicating almost exactly the